Welcome to The Market, sponsored by the CME Group. Dateline, Chicago, Friday, August 18. Hello, everyone. Along with Max Armstrong, I'm Orion Samuelson, looking at another volatile week, particularly on Wall Street. But there was some good news for 4-H this week, and I want to share that with you as well on the program. And we'll talk markets with Jerry Gulke of the Gulke Group in Hinsdale, Illinois. But let's cover the numbers first of all. At the end of the trading day today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, 21,674, a loss of 76 points for the day. The S&P 500 down 4 points for the day. It ended at 2425. The NASDAQ composite down 5 points for the day, ending the week at 6216. And VIX at the CBOE, that's the volatility index, up a little more than, or I should say down a little more than 1.25 points at 1426. For the week, the S&P 500 down 0.2%. The Dow down 0.84%. And the NASDAQ down 0.2%. So those are the numbers on Wall Street. Now let's look at some of the happenings, because it was another volatile session today following the latest White House shakeup and also increased focus on the outlook for the Trump administration's agenda and the post-election rally. While the day's losses were small, today marked the first time stocks haven't risen the day after a more than 1% drop since Donald Trump was elected president back in November. Thursday's 1.5% drop in the S&P 500 came just a week after a similar fall, but was only the fourth decline of more than 1% for the index this year. The turmoil in the White House today: President Trump fired Chief Strategist Steve Bannon, known as an economic nationalist and an advocate of America First policies. And critics have accused him of harboring anti-Semitic and white nationalist sentiments. While stocks turned higher as reports of Bannon's departure began to circulate, they lost those gains heading into the close. And as you heard, all three major indices posted losses for the week. The news followed a week heavy with speculation and focus on the White House. On Thursday, there was concern about the possible departure of National Economic Council Director Gary Cohn, while President Trump disbanded two business councils on Wednesday. About 290 issues on Wall Street marked a 52-week low on this day. That's the most since immediately after the election of Donald Trump. Shares of sporting goods retailers and Deere and Company weighed on the market following disappointing results. Nike's 4.4% slide weighed the most on the S&P and the Dow, following dismal results from sporting goods retailers Foot Locker and Hibbett. And then there was the decline of 5.4% in the stock of Deere. That was the biggest drag on the industrial sector after the farm equipment maker reported a second straight quarter of lower than expected sales. So that's what happened as we ended the trading week today. And so let's take a look at one other commodity and what it did during the week. Oil prices up sharply today as the dollar fell and U.S. drillers cut the number of rigs, feeding a rally that boosted global benchmark Brent crude to a weekly gain, while U.S. crude was virtually flat on the week. The U.S. crude futures for September delivery today up $1.42 to $48.51 a barrel. That's a 3% gain. And Brent crude rose $1.69 to $52.72 a barrel for a gain of a little more than 3%. So let's look ahead to next week. What are we going to be looking at? Well, we'll be focusing on Jackson Hill or Jackson Hole, Wyoming, beginning on Thursday, because top central bankers, including Fed Reserve Chair Janet Yellen and European Central Bank head Mario Draghi, will meet for their annual get-together in Jackson Hole. The policymakers, no doubt, will be collectively wondering why the textbook rule that says low unemployment leads to labor shortages, then higher wages, and then in turn higher inflation, isn't working. And Yellen will be speaking on Friday on financial stability before the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City Economic Symposium. The focus on data will be on U.S. housing data next week. Commerce Department data on Wednesday likely to show new home sales edging up about 0.7% to an annual rate of 611,000 units. And then on Thursday, the National Association of Realtors expected to report that existing home sales increased nearly 1% in July to an annual rate of 5,570,000 units. And then on Friday, Commerce Department will report durable goods, probably showing durable goods falling about 5.5% in July. And what about earnings reports? Well, first of all, HP will report third quarter results on Wednesday, and the hardware maker is expected to report a drop in quarterly profit hurt by slower growth in its printer and copier businesses. Last year, HP bought Samsung Electronic Company's printer business for a little over $1 billion. Lowe's companies will report second quarter results on Wednesday. The number two U.S. home improvement retailer cut its full-year profit forecast in May. The biggest U.S. dollar store chain operator, Dollar Tree Stores, will report second quarter results on Thursday. Its Family Dollar business, taking time to show improvement as its sales have suffered in recent quarters due to delayed tax refunds and reduced food stamp coverage in several U.S. states. Tuesday, perfume maker Coty, which bought P&G's perfume, hair care, and makeup businesses, likely to report an increase in fourth quarter sales. Jewelry retailer Tiffany & Company will announce second quarter results on Thursday. That's one stock that is always followed closely on its earnings reports to see how people are spending their money. U.S. luxury home builder Toll Brothers expected to report an increase in third quarter profit and revenue on Tuesday. Medtronic, the world's largest standalone medical device maker, expected to report its first quarter results before the bell on Tuesday. And investors will focus on the company's plans to bolster its position in the heart device market, where it competes with U.S. rivals Boston Scientific and Edwards Life Sciences Corporation. But like many of you, I have one of Medtronic's products in my chest, and that's the pacemaker. We'll get another look at teen apparel maker and retailer. Teen apparel maker American Eagle Outfitters will report second quarter results on Wednesday, and then teen apparel retailer Abercrombie and Fitch will report second quarter results on Thursday. Samsung Electronics will unveil its new Galaxy Note 8 smartphone in New York on Wednesday, with planned sales to begin in September. So that's what we're looking forward to in the upcoming week. And I guess one other thing we're looking forward to is the solar eclipse on Monday. Doubtful that will have any impact on the market. Speaking of markets, we'll talk agricultural markets. Max Armstrong wants to visit with his guest, Jerry Gulkey of the Gulkey Group in Hinsdale, Illinois, and wants to revisit a subject that came out just a couple of weeks ago. He'll do that when we continue On the Markets, sponsored by the CME Group.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need, today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
Let's just talk once more about that August crop report that came out a few days ago. Have you ever seen a crop number that was so unbelievable to growers? Have you ever heard so many producers say, this is crazy, this can't even be close?
Yeah, I have not. I've seen it happen in October when they have more data to make a more confident decision, because then they'll be harvesting some plots, they'll be counting, counting kernels, they'll be counting rows, they'll be weighing the ears instead of just using statistical data. So I guess based on how they've always done these surveys, talking to farmers, now we have internet, and of course they physically talk to people and ask them, and then their own observations, and they go to farmers and they look at the plot, and they'll go out there and mark off a spot and look at it and say, this is what we think it is, and now when you harvest it, you tell me what you received for yield, and then you compare it. And I was involved in that years ago, and I was astonished at how good they were so early in the year. I think they missed my yield by 4 bushels an acre. So, and this was probably in August, and then when I combined in October, they verify it again, But this time, I don't know what we are to believe or what we are supposed to use in order to manage risk, I guess, of what's coming. But when the crop ratings fall, and we all saw that happening, and we know the crop is late and replant and all this, yet we come up with these numbers. These tech seeds are way beyond our what I thought they were. And I guess the fear that I have is that if we would grow 170 bushel corn this year and 50 bushel beans, given the conditions we have, when will we ever grow one to reduce production supply?
How often do they change the September number significantly from the August crop report? In other words, is it going to be pretty close when it comes out?
That's what they say. And however, they'll use a five-year average. They'll use in the last 2 years, they missed it by a percent. But I don't recall us having years like this where we've had the weather situation we've had and the unknown. Plus, you had an economic incentive starting in last fall, really, to where you would think we'd have planted more soybeans than we did, and yet that hasn't come to fruition yet, but that will when we file all our 578s reports to the government. But there's some economic conditions that some people didn't use spray for their fungicide, and maybe they didn't put on as much P and K as they would have otherwise. We see that in some of the fertilizer reports. So is that going to come back to haunt us in here somewhere? And things look good, and yet we've already reduced, Iowa yields. We know they're going to be down. Illinois is not what it was last year. So we've taken some of those core states down, but the media seems to be concentrating on the fact that the South has such an unbelievable crop. They're up 20 bushels an acre from last year. Well, they produce 5 million acres. There's not as significant as South Dakota, perhaps.
Right.
So 20 bushels is 100 million bushels. That's you spill that much, going to harvest probably. So. But that helped, but I don't think it's I'm still kind of baffled, and I still suspect that yield may come down in corn when we finally harvest it. Soybeans are still a wild card. You know how they are. We've got time yet to make or break that crop.
While we're talking about crops and crop conditions, zero in on Iowa with me for just a moment with that corn crop. I mean, I was in that pocket in northwest Iowa last weekend, Albert City, Pocahontas, mm-hmm. Storm Lake, and they have really had an intense drought there. Conversely, I talked to folks from northeast Iowa, not exactly the big producing counties of Iowa, but they're in the land of milk and honey. However, you go on up into Minnesota, into big counties, and there the crop looks very good.
Yep.
So help me understand what's happened to the Iowa corn crop. Will that yield climb, perhaps?
I think it's over in those areas that were bad. I've looked at the corn and
moisture's too late to help them.
Yeah, a lot of them are, the ears are fired. The stalks are fired. The leaves up to the ear. And picking some of the cobs, you'll see where it wasn't just tip back; it was poor pollination. And I think a lot of them are looking at 28 long kernels and 16 around, perhaps. But whatever, I think it's pretty hard to bring that back. You know, we always think, well, rain in the middle of August will help beans. Rain might sustain that corn crop from dropping another 10 bushels an acre or whatever. But some of our clients who've got an APH over 200 bushels an acre have had yield checks by agronomists of 150 bushels an acre. And they may be off by 20, but even 170 is, you look at the crop, and I know what 170 bushel corn looks like, and that's not it. So that's 50 bushels less than last year in that vein through northwest Iowa to southeast. But we're reflecting that in the total yield in Iowa. And I have to keep reminding myself daily, almost under times of strife, that an average yield, trend line yield, is some good and some bad. Well, you hear about the bad, but there is some good corn, like you say, and but we're starting to see some yields come in parts of Illinois that were marginal and test plots, and they're running 20 to 30 bushels less than last year. And yet the USDA, you look at what they pegged in for Illinois, it's down from last year. We've already, you wonder how much worse it could get. So it has to come in test weight. We don't know what the ear weights are anywhere yet. And that could be a big deal, because if you go back to 2013 actual test weights that they didn't back into, but they weren't implied, but what they were actually, you could see a 7 or 8% drop in test weight nationally, and you know that's a chunk. That's like taking the yield down from maybe down another 5 or 6 bushels back down to where we thought it was to begin with.
Before I leave this topic of the August crop report, were the expectations built so strongly among farmers by all of these? And you say we always think about the bad.
Yeah.
And looking at all of those social media photos circulating around out there about lousy crops and farmers pushing those around, it reminds me of the coffee shops back in the mid-'80s.
Right.
You know, can you top this bad news? Yeah. That was always what was going on then.
Yeah.
So the expectations were built so strongly going into this report.
Yeah, and they were in the grains to some point. We saw the weather kind of changing in the first week after the 4th of July. We topped the corn market at the time that it looked the worst. You know, if you go back and look at the media hype, the internet and so forth, that was when things looked the worst. And boy, if it never rains again, we'll be lucky to get 100 bushels. Well, then it started to change. The heat was over. We started getting some rains. As my friend tells me, that the dry areas were getting smaller and the wet areas were getting bigger. So you stop that. And we didn't go to $4.50 like we did last year, but we had 500 million bushels more carried in, mm-hmm. left over. So that would tell you that under a similar circumstance of psychologically believing that we got a problem here, we shouldn't have gotten to 450. We topped out about 417, and that was difficult to sell at that level. But I remember telling my clients, you know, get your selling attitude on. We're going to have to price some grain pretty quick. And boy, I got taken to the woodshed. You know, well, if you're bearish corn, come look at my farm, you know. And of course, it's very difficult for a farmer to sell a poor crop. But there's nothing worse than having 150 bushel corn at 380 or 360 and not selling at $4. It's a difficult year this year for everybody. And I think we've just, we did not need this year in agriculture. There'll be some sections of the country that, you know, aren't going to have a crop, you know. And Mother Nature is no respecter of persons. And so it'll be interesting to see how it all boils out at the end.
How much old crop corn is still sitting around in bins ahead of the arrival of this new crop?
Well, I would say if we don't get it to market by September 1st, it's probably not coming because you'll start harvesting. We're harvesting already down south, but, you know, there's preparation time, and we'll harvest in October. So most of us, if we had to clear the bins out, we had to get it going and get it done by September 1. And if we had a DP contract, a delayed pricing, from last fall, we paid them for the privilege of waiting for the price to go down. Now we have to make that decision on September 1st in commercial storage, or you pay a minimum storage to store it till February 1st. So there's some decisions that made, and that's probably why in the past few years, the warnings of us having a terrible time with prices at the end of the year didn't materialize, because we kind of bottomed the markets on September 1. Not so sure as we do that this year with such an influx of not just corn from here, but in South America that will continue to fall, haunt us maybe during our harvest time.
So that corn is still coming to market out of the Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah, oh yeah, it will be. There's quite a bit of corn left. And in fact, Brazil is even thinking about now of building, or they have built, I believe, in the process, a private concern that's going to use corn only for ethanol, not sugar. And it's inefficient compared to sugar. But the comment was, we've got to do something about our surplus. So in all that, we're building demand, which is silently under there. And we look at that every year. Demand keeps going up. You know, we use about 200 or 300 million bushels or 500 million bushels, a half a billion bushels of corn more globally every year than we do the previous year. And that continues.
That's the silver lining out there somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. One of these days, you know, we're going to produce a subpar crop that's still going to look good. And someone's going to say, well, why are we at $4.50 or $5 a bushel when we've got 2 billion bushels left over? It's because the rest of the world is in need of the grain. And beans are probably the most exciting one, because we need to continue to increase acres globally just to keep up with the way I calculate about a 5 million bush, 5 million acre equivalent at 50 bushels an acre increase that we've seen grow over the years. And it's not just China. Just about every country out of hundreds of countries, perhaps, but say the top 100 have increased the demand, their personal demand, for not only what they grow themselves, but what they buy to supplement. Everybody grows something, but they have to import. So
many of those are Southeast Asian nations,
yes,
right?
And they're just kind of coming on, you know. Vietnam's one of them, you know, Indonesia. And then, of course, we don't talk much about India, but they grow soybeans. And so it's not all about China. So it's the good news is that a global economy didn't melt down like we thought, irregardless of who's in office and what dictator is where. We're still improving the demand globally, and that's good. That's good for the economy. At least we don't have to worry about inflation and food just yet.
As always, our thanks to Jerry Gulke of the Gulke Group, headquartered in Hinsdale, Illinois, for sharing his market expertise on the market sponsored by the CME Group.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
Lisa Diaz is the director of 4-H in the state of Illinois. And we're here at the Illinois State Fair. We're on opening day. Something happened to 4-H that will impact 4-H'ers across the nation. What happened?
Well, we were very excited to be hosting the announcement of a major philanthropic gift to National 4-H. It's going to change how we think about preparing young people for the future. Google has announced that Illinois in 4-H, along with 22 other states in the nation, will be receiving $1.5 million to create a brand new career pathway for young people into computer science and new technology fields.
Well, I know you just received it, but what are you expecting for 4-H members because of this grant?
Well, here in Illinois, and it already happened at the fair on Friday, we had our Googlers here. We've already started training young people to be the up-and-coming Googlers. They're helping to introduce technologies like virtual reality. So we'll be using drone technology to take aerial footage, as well as our other kinds of video that can be put together in creating virtual reality 3D experiences for anyone and our youth. And this is really important to the partnership with Google and 4-H, is that we see young people not just as consumers of technology, they love their video games and their YouTube, but we know that these are the creators of tomorrow's technology. So with this partnership with Google, we'll be creating opportunities for kids to learn how to program things like virtual reality experiences to teach people about any number of things.
Is this the first such grant to 4-H, and will there be more in different areas, do you think?
You know, 4-H has gotten the attention of an increasing number of corporate donors who recognize that we really play a unique role in preparing young people for the future. We've been around for over 100 years. We're represented in every county and every community of the nation. We're administered through a network of higher ed institutions, land grant institutions. We have a history of youth leadership that excels, with kids serving in leadership roles at the club level, county, state, national, international. 4-H is in 40 countries around the world. So they're recognizing the excellence that comes out of this program and the reach that we have around the country.
And for urban families who at one time thought 4-H was cows, corn, pigs, and soybeans, that has changed dramatically.
It has changed. And what I like to remind people that have known 4-H in those historical roots, we are all that. Today we're celebrating Ag Day here at State Fair and the excellence of the many, many families who have made 4-H part of their way of life and raised their kids in 4-H. This weekend I was celebrating leaders in 4-H who've been around for 50 years, who have been serving the organization. We had a 69-year 4-H leader. So we have those families, and that's an important part of 4-H. And we are so much more. We have robotics, we have filmmaking, we have computer science, new drone technology. So we like to tell people that 4-H is that organization you can depend on to have strong roots in what feeds our country and our nation, and is also changing with the times so that the cutting edge technology learning opportunities can happen in 4-H. It's a place for everybody.
Well, we certainly thank Lisa for that good news for 4-H. And yes, indeed, there is a home for every youngster in 4-H in this country and around the world. Our thanks to Google for that financial support for 4-H. Well, as we ended the trading day today, live cattle futures cut losses after falling to their lowest price level in 9 months, led by this week's steep drop in cash cattle prices. So at the end of the day, at the beginning of trade on Monday morning, here's where we'll start. I'm looking at a red screen for today's trade. October lean hogs will start the trade on Monday at $66.12 a hundredweight after dropping 97 cents today. August live cattle dropped a half dollar today. They'll start trading at $106.37 on Monday. And August feeder cattle will start trading at $140.50 after dropping just 10 cents a hundredweight today. The grain market, corn, soybeans, wheat, all moved higher for the day, but lower for the week. All three commodities ended the week lower than they were a week ago. So where do we start with the trade when we go back to work on Monday in the trading community? Well, we'll take a look at September wheat. Today, that market dropped, or I should say gained, 3.5 cents a bushel. So it'll start trading at $4.16 Monday. December corn, 3.65¾ for the beginning trade on Monday, and it dropped just 0.75 cents today, or gained 0.75 cents. And November soybeans gained a nickel a bushel. They'll start trading next week at $9.37¾ a bushel. And of course, next week, Half Century of Progress show in Rantoul, Illinois. We'll see you there. When I say we, I say Max Armstrong and me, Orion Samuelson. Thank you for joining us on The Market, sponsored by the CME Group.